Hi, this is Paula Morrell. Welcome to Tales from the South.
The rain is softly falling. Indian summer kind of night. Harvest moon slowly creeping up the sky to hang alive. Up the sky, hang light.
So how's everybody doing tonight? How about tonight's music by Amy Garland and Nick Devlin? Do y'all like Amy and Nick? Amy Garland and Nick Devlin have just released a brand new record, Hang a Light, which is already receiving numerous radio plays. This record contains some of Amy's finest songs to date. She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found on Reverb Nation. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, part of our Living Legends series, where legendary Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark has appeared with John Weston twice on Beale Street Caravan Radio Show. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Tonight, our featured artist is Little Rock Mosaic artist Stephanie Darnell, and our featured piece is the one here behind me, this stained glass mosaic window, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this mosaic window and Stephanie at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Born in Lexi, Arkansas in 1931, Ollie Brantley signed with the Negro Leagues Baseball's Memphis Red Sox in 1951. After his first year pitching with the Red Sox and winning 10 games, he returned for a second year, and then in 1953, he signed with the Chicago White Sox. At the time, Ollie was the only black player with the White Sox organization. Ollie continued his career with the White Sox for 7 years. Then from 1961 to 1969, he would play for the Minnesota Twins organization. At one point in his career, Ollie joined the Willie Mays All-Star team and barnstormed the countryside with the Mickey Mantle All-Stars. They would play 25 games together, traveling to different cities, always offering the fans an exciting game. After 18 years of playing professional baseball, Ollie retired. He now lives in Marianna, Arkansas, and enjoys quail and deer hunting, as well as fishing. Tonight, Ollie is going to tell stories of his life and baseball from a bygone era of segregation, but full of friendship, camaraderie, and courage. Ladies and gentlemen, Ollie Brantley.
I'd like to say good evening to all of you all this afternoon. I appreciate everything, and I'm honored to be here today. I'm Ollie Brantley from Marion, Arkansas. I was born and raised in Phillips County, a little small town called Lexi. I'm here tonight to tell you all something about my baseball career. And I graduated in 1951 from Liza Miller High. And the year that I graduated, I got signed by the Memphis Red Sox, the Negro League. And that year, I went into Memphis. When I got there, I never been in a stadium before. So the manager said, you're gonna be pitching tonight. I said, okay. So everybody took the field. I was still standing in the dugout, and he said, aren't you gonna take the mound? I said, I don't know where the mound is. I ain't been in this ballpark before. I proceeded on the mound, and the first pitch I threw, I guess, about 20 feet high over the catcher. I was real nervous, so he came out. He said, Brandon, just settle down. I'm going to give you the target. So I kind of settled down, and once I got settled down, I struck out, I think, to the side. And, you know, I was a pitcher. I didn't know anything about how fast, you know, they timing anybody, and they didn't have a clock at that time, but I could really throw hard. So my dad, he had taught me about throwing. At first, I started throwing sidearm. You know, we had a barn down there, and we lived on a farm. My dad was a sharecropper, and I learned how to throw from him. He said, look, you throw the ball over the top. Don't throw over the side. So we had a walnut tree there in the backyard, and the barn was down about 250 feet. And I tried to throw the ball down to the barn, and I throw sidearm, and it hooked. He said, what did I tell you? Throw the ball over the top. So I started throwing over the top. I started throwing to the barn. I got so good, I was throwing over the barn. So he said, that's what I want you to do. So he made me a ball out of a sock. A sweat sock. He raveled it with a cork and made me a ball and everything. And he said, now, I'm going to draw a circle on a smokehouse. That's where we kept our meat. You know, everybody then that killed hogs, you keep your meat in there. So he said, I want you to throw in that circle. Sometime I wouldn't, sometime I would. So that's how I learned how to have control. And going on back to say it, in Memphis when I was pitching and everything, I was 18 years old, and man, I was striking out 16 and 17, and I didn't have no idea, you know, I was going to play organized ball. The Negro League was organized ball for blacks, but I didn't know nothing about the major leagues. So I played that year, and they kept telling me the scouts was following you, on maybe sign you, so I didn't think so. So the next year, I went to the East and West game in Chicago. They had about 40,000. I had never been in a ballpark like that, you know, a major league park. Man, I pitched 3 innings and struck out 9 in 3 innings. So the manager told me, said that you know, these scouts is here on you, watching you. So when I came back in the dugout and everything, so they said the White Sox are trying to sign you and the Giants and several teams. So I came back and I played that 1952 and 53. I went back to the East and West game. And I was an outstanding pitcher there, and I don't know how many I struck out, but I struck out quite a few. I could throw in the 90s, but I guess around in the low 90s or high 90s, I don't know just what they told me after that, that the White Sox had purchased my contract. So I said, purchased my contract? I was so happy, you know, and I didn't say, I thought I was going to be there with the White Sox. So they kept me in Chicago for 3 days working out, and Sherman Lotta was the catcher. And he said, boy, he said, you know what? He said, you got enough on the ball, you might be up here with us. You know, they had met him, I said, no, so. So 3 days later, they called me in the office, and they told me, said, now, three things you're going to have to do. We're going to send you up to Sheboygan, Wisconsin. I said, Sheboygan, Wisconsin? He said, yeah. I said, ain't no black people up there at all now. He said, you get up there, they're going to have a place for you to stay. I got up there, they had a storage house in the backyard, it was fenced around it. I got up there, and the lady and the landlord, they took me out there. They had facilities in there. And I got up the next morning, about 150 kids outside the fence looking. I came outside, and they say, what is that? What is that? I ain't never seen it. What is that? You don't know. They were talking to each other, you know. They had never seen a black person that hadn't been up there. I said, well, what is he? What is it? All that. So the lady came out. She said, he colored. They say, colored? Why is he so black? What he been so dirty? Been in the sun, got him burnt? That actually happened. You know, little kids bagging him. She said, well, you shake hands with him. They're bagging up for me. She said, he colored. So I went on, and the next 2 or 3 days, I had to pitch. Man, everybody in the ballpark was alarmed. I had the paper. Colored pitcher here in Wisconsin, Sheboygan, gonna pitch. Man, he couldn't get in the ballpark. They had signs up, Black Sambo, don't let that end get you out, boy, and all this. That night, I struck out 18. They swinging at anything I do. But what had happened, see, the big brass was there. Every time I pitched, they would make sure they were there. And the manager was telling me, he said, boy, you need to go on back and play in the Black League. This too tough for you. And I was already wanting to quit and go back, you know, I didn't know what to do. And so they told me, the main people from Chicago said, you stay here. One of these days, you'll be up with the White Sox, you'll be a rich man. I said, I don't know if I can or not. Every day, the manager bring me out at 12 and work me out with the catcher. The other guys would work out at 5 o'clock. They'd take batting practice, and they had to go down on the end of the bleachers. Man, they'd be turning black cats loose and watermelons and saying things. Man, my ears, I didn't know what to do. I was nervous. And then when I get ready to go home, the police had to take me home. And that went on for that summer. Man, I don't know how I made it. And the next year, they sent me to Waterloo, Iowa. I thought it was going to be better. I got there. I couldn't stay in a hotel there. Same thing on the road. Didn't even find no colored hotels in them cities up there. Wisconsin, Rapids, Des Moines. Same thing. I said, well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. And my wife said, look, just stick with it. And then they sent me down to South Carolina, Maine. Got down there in the Carolina League. I couldn't ride the bus. They had a state trooper, fake state trooper on the hill, be a fake one, and the next would be a real state trooper. So they had a station wagon for me to ride in, had a White Sox Farm Club on it. And I was going through there, and I got lost one night, it was raining. And I was on the wrong road. I guess I was going all across the road. Didn't know, I was excited. State trooper stopped me. Boy, where you going? Get out the car. Put your hand up on the cab, spread eagle. I did. He said, you done stole this car? I said, no, sir. You disputing me? He had that billy stick up. I didn't say nothing. He said, well, look, you lost, find the best way you can. We're trying to get to Knoxville. Man, I went on up in there, found some colored people, showed me how to get back on the road. Man, there was something else back there. I got there about 4:35. I had to sleep in the station wagon till the manager come get me. And then them towns, see, in that town, they had a black hotel. Put me in there. I'd be in there until they come get me in the evening. And you couldn't work out. When I did pitch up in that league, I had a chair and sat on the outside of the dugout. They wouldn't let me sit in the dugout. That actually happened back there in the 50s. But it got better in the 60s. You know, and when I was playing in the 60s, it got better. And I was playing in another league, started staying in the hotel. In 1958, I played in the Western League. And that's the class A, they did the top form club. And they did have another black guy, Sam Harrison. You heard of his third or fourth generation, his boys. That's their granddaddy at that time, Sam Harrison. And he was my catcher. And I won, I think, 15 games that year. And I had a, you know, it got better and better as the time went by. But back in the early 50s, it was tough. But I want to tell you a story that I know you want to hear. We was in Savannah, Georgia. And a guy knocked one of our guys down. And the manager come out there and said, boy, I said, look, I want you to put that ball on that boy's side. I said, no, sir, I can't do that. He said, boy, I have you on that bus going back to Arkansas chopping cotton before you get the wood. You do what I say do. We not going to have nobody knock our man down and you don't knock him down. I said, well, what am I going to do? Man, all them guys come out there trumping on me. But I said, he said, you do what I say. So the first baseman, this boy, Don Mitchell, he came over and he said, look, we're going to have your back, man. Go on, hit him. And he was hollering in the stand, don't let that boy hit you. Don't let him hit you. I wind up and hit that boy, and they took off after me, and I took off to center field. When they got there, I was on that flag post. You know, got a little skinny flag filled with the flag. I was up on the top of the fence. So the police had to come and get me. I was through for that night. I told them, man, I can't pitch no more. They were wrestling all over the field, my teammates. They were wrestling with him, but I wasn't going to stay there. I took off. I knew he was going to get after me and see when I hit him. And man, you should have heard them people. Man, they was hollering, don't let him hit you, don't let him hit you. And I hit him, and I had to take off. Yeah.
So at the time you were playing for the White Sox, you were the only black player,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, I was the only black at the time for long. They had Minnie Minoso. See, they signed me early in 1953. And it was kind of tough being along that time. They didn't have that many black players. But, Pittsburgh was trying to sign me, but I think the White Sox made a better offer. See, in the Black League at that time, they couldn't survive it, and they were trying to get black players. That's what broke the league up. But when we were playing in the Negro League, traveling, we had Charlie Pride. I'll tell you about that. He was my roommate with the Memphis Red Sox. Man, he'd be on there with guitar all night. We ride a bus all night long. He on there. I said, man, when you gonna let her get some sleep? He said, I'm going to sing this song for y'all all night. We ride into a town. If it get rained out, you know, we didn't get no meal money. We didn't have no meal money. We had to carry our own grocery on the road because we couldn't go in the place. When they get gas, you couldn't go in the front. They wouldn't let you come in there. We had our own water. And trying to get some sleep with Charlie Pride was something else. That man, he had his guitar, and then he had a comb. he was real comical. He stayed on there. But I think he left after I left. But I heard that he was singing on the bus somewhere up in Michigan. And the guy come out and heard him sing. And he asked him, would you come in and strum up a few songs for us? He said, you sure you want me to come in there, man? I'm a spade. He said, I know you're a spade. He said, but you colored, ain't you? Yeah. He said, you let my teammates come in. They told him no. He went in there. He started to sing. The man said, you need to put that uniform down and glove and follow me to New York. That's where he got started. The man took him to New York. That's where he got his start from. And he's a famous singer now. If y'all got any questions to ask me, I'd be glad to answer some of them if I can.
Mr. Brantley, we had a little conversation a while ago, and I was interested in your perspective on education and athletics and athletes.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you would talk about that just a little bit.
Well, when I was coming up, my mother had always told me she wanted me to finish high school. You know, they had split session at that time, and we were sharecroppers, and I had six brothers there. I was the youngest, and two sisters. And they all didn't graduate, but I did. She wanted me to graduate. You know, we had farm and split session. So she'd had to walk me to the grade school. The road was so bad sometimes that you couldn't get down there with a wagon. She'd walk me, my daddy, and she wanted me to go. So I finished high school back in the day. And after I was in baseball, I met my wife. She had finished high school and went to college for Atlanta Smith College. And we got married, and I was playing baseball then with the White Sox organization. And she went on to University of Arkansas and got her master's. My girls were young at that time. And when they finished high school, they went to UCA. Both of them graduated from UCA. And both of them have a master's. My wife got her master's from University of Arkansas. So they, one of them worked for Chase Bank. That she does just computer analysis, and then she work on these loans. And my other girl is a nurse. She has a master's. She's a manager of a hospital in Dallas. And she've always, you know, I've always told my kids, you know, I want to see them graduate and go to college. That's what my mother wanted me to do. I didn't get a chance to get no college education. I took some hours, but after I was playing baseball, I didn't get a chance to go. But my kids all graduated from college. And I preach it to the kids today, you know, these black kids today, most of them from single parent in these projects, and their parents don't really tell them what the value of education is. You know, they think if they're on the welfare, they're going to be on there all the time. But see, they don't know that they get an education, they don't have to be on the welfare. I tell them that they get my education, go to college. Don't make no difference where you're from and who you are. You get your education, and you succeed. Now, we're going back to the baseball, talking about the black kids. Now, they done left the baseball field. You know, when I come along, every kid was playing stickball, baseball. But now, they are playing basketball and football. You don't see too many African-Americans in the major league. You see Spanish kids. Because of basketball is a sport that's a lot of fun, you know, and they have this intramural basketball. They play all the year. They don't even play no baseball. You can't hardly get them out to play. Even Little League kids, 9 to 12, they don't want to play. They want to play basketball. See, and in basketball, if you ain't 6'8 or 6'9, you ain't got no chance. If you 6'8 or 6'9, out of 100, might make it. Your chances are slim. In football, you got to be over 200, maybe a running back, maybe a wide receiver would be 175, but that's rare. And the linemen's 290 and 300. And these kids go out and think they're going to make it to the pros, they're wrong, see, because they don't have the size. But now in baseball, you can be 125-pound run, hit, you can go to major leagues. I tell them that all the time. I talk to these kids, but they don't want to listen. They want to go play basketball. Every kid on the corner got a goal up. When I was coming up, every kid on the corner had a baseball and a stick playing baseball. And so that's why you don't see no Afro-American men in the major league. You see a few, most of them are Spanish boys in the major leagues.
I'm a baseball fan. I just finished watching the playoffs, college and the College World Series.
Yes, sir.
And there are not very many blacks, as you say. Do you think African-Americans can be brought back into the baseball game?
Yes, sir. I think you take in high school, most of them high school don't even have baseball. Now, you take in the College World Series, I've seen three or four boys playing. I think UCLA had two or three. I think Mississippi State got one, maybe LSU. The Razorbacks don't have any, and the man wants them. But I talked to the coach, but he can't find any in Arkansas that's want to play in the baseball. You know, they go out of state, it's hard to find them, to get them, you know, on the college team. And the Razorbacks had 11 boys got drafted. I talked to the kids about it, and that many kids from there got drafted, but they're all white kids. And I said, you black kids got a chance to go up there and play. But they don't go out for baseball. And that's a hard thing to understand after we've paid all these dues down through the years fighting to get them into baseball and they don't want to play. So that's the big question. They had the major league teams offer to give $50,000 in the town, you know, if you got the idea, and get to lure some Afro-American players back out. But they just, for some reason, they don't want to come out. So I don't know what it's going to take to get them back out on the field. Because it's a lot of kids could be major league ball players because they can run and throw. Most kids is fast and run. Like I told them, I said, if you can run and throw, they'll learn you how to hit. And then if you can run, you might be just a pinch runner. You'd be at second base, make $850,000. That's what the minimum is. And when I was playing, it was $10,000. So they paid me a pension now because I was discriminated against, and I get $833 a month. But that's equivalent to the $10,000 back in the 50s. You take guys like Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, they'd be millionaires here playing today. They the kind of money they're paying. So you start out with a major league contract, $850,000. Some of those boys from over at university, I don't know if they got a major league contract, but some deals they give you a major league contract plus a bonus, and then you got 4 years to make it. And they farm them out. That don't mean they don't have a major league contract like the Travelers. They got some kids out there and I got a major league contract, but they farmed out to the Travelers. And they usually bring them up at the end of the year, you know, like in August and September. Some of them just playing out there making that minimum salary or more. And look at the bonuses they get. We got a kid from Forest City. He got signed this year. I knew him. We were pitching for the Razorbacks. And he got signed with the Milwaukee Brewers. I think he signed. And I don't know if Stanek signed or not, but he don't get a lot of money because he went first round. I heard he hadn't signed. But another young man was with Oregon last year. They drafted him, I think, first round and offered him so many million that he wouldn't take it. So he done doubled his contract, but he came back and had a good year. Now, we had a young man that playing football, Wilson, last year. He could have went in the draft as a quarterback and made double the money that he got this year. You know, his stock fell. Because of, you know, the kind of team we had. But that happens. But I think he'll make it up, you know, if he still stay there, because he's a good quarterback.
Mr. Brantley, in the notes tonight, said that you were playing during the Willie Mays teams and the Mickey Mantle series.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
See, I was when the black major league player was playing Mickey Mantle All-Star, they didn't have enough black pitchers. So they choose me. I made more money barnstorming with them than I did the regular season. You know, I was glad to get a chance. But I could pitch my term against the major league, Mickey Mantle and all, and we won some games, lost some. So they felt like I could pitch in the major league, but I guess the White Sox didn't think so at that time. I was in AAA, and then when the major league cut their team in the spring, you know, they going to send you down because they had a lot of ball players they had money invested in, but they'd send me down. I won 24 ball games in 1957 in Northwest League. And I thought, sure, you know, I went to spring training with the White Sox, stayed there the last day, they cut you and send me to Indianapolis. Then when they cut their team, they send them to Indianapolis, I go down. And that's the way it was for blacks back in the day. But today, I believe if I was back in the day, 40, 50 years from today, I believe I'd be in the major leagues.
Was the Willie Mays team all blacks
They had a Hank Aaron and all those guys playing against Mickey Mantle and all those guys up in the major leagues. Yeah. They Major League All-Stars, and we'd go down to Mexico. We played about 15 games down there after the World Series. And then we'd play through Mississippi and places like that. You know, the park would be full because they wanted to see the Major League ball players. And I was glad to get the chance to be one of the pitchers. I was pitching my term every 4 days. And going back to tell you, when I first got started, you know, pitcher had to go 9 innings when I got in the professional ball with the White Sox. I pitched my turn. In one game, I went almost 18 innings before they took me out. It wasn't no short relievers then. You had to go 9 innings back in the day. And I have pitched 9 innings, and then they bring me in relief in some games. It wasn't no short reliever like the other day. You pitch 5 or 6 innings, and then somebody come in relief. That was out. And then one thing, the White Sox had Dick Donovan and all them guys, Billy Pearson at that time. Wasn't a way to break in the lineup because they had a set pitching staff back in the day. You just didn't come in and they bring a pitcher in. They had set pitching staff. And also I played winter baseball. You know, your prospects, they always say they sent them to winter ball. They sent me down to South America and Nicaragua and Arizona. And I just thought, sure, you know, I'd be in the major league, but never get there. Played AAA.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Ollie Brantley, for being on our Living Legends series on Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to ULR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.